from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. This is Innovation Navigation on Business Radio. Here is Professor David Robertson.
And welcome to Innovation Navigation on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm Dave Robertson. I'll be joining you here on Sirius XM Channel 111 every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern and replayed throughout the week. So today's a big day for me personally. It's the publication date of my new book, The Power of Little Ideas, A Low-Risk, High-Reward Approach to Innovation. In last week's show, I interviewed Sarah Rabo Hagen, whose turnaround of Gatorade was a lead story in my book. And this week and future weeks, we're going to cover some of the other stories in the book. The central idea of the book is that innovation doesn't always have to be disruptive. The main point of the book is that, you know, too often on this show and elsewhere, you hear that there is two types of innovation. There's the incremental improvement of current products for current customers, or there's the revolutionary disruption of markets and industries that change the fortunes of the companies inside them. And I think both of those types of innovation are real and important, but they're not the only way you can innovate. That, in fact, there's a number of companies that were doing a different type of innovation that was neither incremental nor radical, that it was really innovating not inside the box nor outside the box, but around the box, that coming up with a family of complementary innovations around an existing product or service without changing that product or service was a different approach to innovation, a tricky approach to do, but one that could have some pretty significant benefits. And so what we're going to be doing today and in a couple of future shows is highlighting some of the more interesting examples and finding out what's happened since I put them in the book. And today we're going to be looking at a trifecta of interesting industries: sex, drugs, and alcohol. Specifically, we're going to look at innovation in cannabis, lingerie, and beer. First, we're going to talk about the marijuana and lingerie business with journalist and Forbes contributor Deborah Borchardt. In many eyes, these two industries differ drastically, but I think that they share some similar lessons about innovation and how leaders can think about the space and about innovating around their product. And then returning to the program are two individuals who brewed up a clever way to increase sales at Guinness. Consultant and former Guinness senior brand manager Donal Balance and senior project manager for the Irish pub company Darren Fagan are going to join us to talk about their Irish pub concept. Now, they were on the show a year and a half ago, and we'll briefly recap what the Irish pub concept is. But basically, it's building a shrine to Guinness. It didn't change the product at all, but it really helped sell more Guinness by building authentic Irish pubs all over the world. So we'll catch up on that story, what's been happening in the last year and a half, and where it's going from here. As always, you can find out more about our guests at our website, innonavi.com. That's INNONAVI.com. You can get links to books and blogs and websites. We are redoing the site this week, so if you get some strange things happening, let us know. It's probably some glitch in our transition phase. And also, we are randomly selecting a Facebook follower or Facebook liker to receive a free signed copy of my book. And so by all means, go to Facebook, follow us on Facebook, like our page. It's Innovation Navigation. So that's facebook.com/innovationnavigation. And our Facebook follower of the week is Christy Murphy from Plymouth, Massachusetts. So Christy, send us a message with your address, and I'll email you and I'll mail you a copy of the book. So, in a move to strike fear in the hearts of any company management team, I used Victoria's Secret as a case study in my new book, as a success story. And there's no more reliable way to ensure a downturn in a business than to be featured as a success story in a business book. But I got to say, I stand by the story. I wrote that Victoria's Secret was second to market behind Frederick's of Hollywood. They were struggling. They went bankrupt in 1982. But they made a major change, which allowed them to recover and essentially put Frederick's of Hollywood out of business. Frederick's of Hollywood closed its last physical store in 2015. And what Victoria's Secret did was that they realized their customer was not men buying for their spouses and girlfriends, but that women were purchasing their lingerie, and that they, and what Victoria's Secret did that Fredericks of Hollywood didn't, was that they changed the whole image of the stores from one of provocative, even wanton lingerie that encouraged sex to one of kind of beautiful intimate wear that encouraged romantic love. And the way they had encouraged that is, of course, by changing the product and making them less lascivious, but also building a family of complementary innovations around the product. Instead of selling sex toys like Fredericks of Hollywood, they sold perfume and cosmetics and classical music, demure sleepwear. And they changed their catalogs to become less like softcore pornography and more like, you know, Cosmo or Vanity Fair, you know, some fashion layout. But Victoria's Secret is struggling now. And so we invited Deborah on the show. Deborah Borchardt is a journalist and Forbes contributor and has covered Victoria's Secret for Forbes magazine. Deborah, welcome to Innovation Navigation.
Thank you, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's a difficult process. I hesitate to compare it to giving birth, since I have no. I was partly involved in that process, but I can't really compare. But it's nice
it's
to
your
have
baby.
It. Out, yeah, it is my baby. So Deborah, you've looked at Victoria's Secret. Why are they struggling?
You know, it's interesting because when you look at really the history of bras and intimate apparel, it goes through cycle and it changes, and you know. To go over a delicate issue, the trend of the way a woman's silhouette looks on her chest also changes with the time. So like you saw in the 20s, the flapper era, women were very small and they did not, you know, push up their chests. And then you got into the 50s when you had the bullet bra and they were very pointy silhouette. And then you got into the 60s, and it was, you know, let's be free and let's burn our bras. And so it was a very natural look. Then you got into the 80s, which is really when Victoria's Secret really came to life. And the silhouette was this push-up. You know, remember the 80s, the big hair, the big, you know, growth in breast jobs. So big boobs was the thing. Well, we've kind of started to cycle out of that trend and that look. Now the style is back to kind of a more natural look, a smaller look. The millennials are not favoring double D boob jobs anymore. They're looking at bralettes. And so Victoria's Secret has kind of been caught in this changing trend of what women want their chest to look like. And they've been slow to adapt to that change. And that's where they've kind of gotten caught short. They were still pushing the push-up bra when women were wanting to buy sports bras and bralettes. And so they got caught in that. Then they also got caught in really kind of a changing cultural shift of hypersexuality. So we went away from Abercrombie and Fitch pushing, you know, shirtless male models at the front of the store, and like you said, kind of soft porn looking catalogs to a much more modest look. And again, Victoria's Secret was very slow to change to that, and their catalogs were still pushing that very hypersexual look. This is also at a time when you have to realize what's happening on college campuses, and we all know about the attention brought to sexual assaults and unwanted sexual attention. So women in the college campus area, they also are toning down this hypersexuality look. And so Victoria's Secret has been changing, but they were very slow to come to that change. Now, if you look at the business for Victoria's Secret, you see that their core lingerie business, which is the push-up bra, has come down dramatically. The sales have dropped. But their pink brand, which is back to that bralette, that minimal look, that less sexy look, those
Deborah, describe for our listeners, what is a bralette?
Okay, so a bralette is basically a bra that doesn't have a cup size. So when women buy bras, it's 34B, 36C. So it's the size of your waist, your chest, the width, and then the cup size for the size of the actual breast going into the bra. and a bralette doesn't really have a size. It's just kind of a stretchy elastic thing with a lot of lace, kind of meant to be seen under a shirt that kind of exposes it a little. So it's a real style trend.
But it's kind of halfway between a bra and a sports bra?
Yeah, like okay. A lacy sports bra.
Okay. Yeah, so you were saying about pink, that pink is doing well and has transitioned to the bralette, but Victoria's Secret hasn't?
It really hasn't. That's what they call the core lingerie. Now, when you go into a Victoria's Secret store, you'll see the two sections, the pink section and the Victoria's Secret core lingerie section. The problem with that is that their core lingerie is still pushing that super sexy thing, that push-up bra. It's still pushing that look, and women are kind of coming away from that look right now. It really isn't the trend. And the stores still have that boudoir look, and that really isn't where women are at right now anymore. So it's like they've recognized that things have changed, but it's like an ocean liner. It's very slow to adapt. Now, they have made dramatic changes in the last year. They've laid off a lot of people. They've cut out their swimwear business. They've cut out their apparel business in order to focus on fixing the lingerie business. So to your point about innovation, at least this company is smart enough to realize that they needed to make those changes when a lot of these big companies don't ever recognize they need to make those changes.
They still, one of the things that I was struck by in terms of Victoria's Secret strategy is their airport stores. I was in both the Philly and the Boston airport this week, but I've seen these in the Middle East. Last time I was in Dubai, there's a Victoria's Secret store in the airport. They're all over the place. They're in the UK. And one thing you can't buy in the Victoria's Secret airport stores is bras. You can't buy most of their lingerie. There's a couple of panties and things like that. But mostly it's the complementary products. It's the cosmetics and the perfumes and some of the sleepwear. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And it seems like they're more oriented toward, if I had to guess their one customer that buys more than anything else, it's that guy coming back from the business trip buying something for his wife or girlfriend, that it's more male-oriented than female-oriented. Is that accurate?
I would say, too, that that's true. One of the things about being in the lingerie business, and I confess, at one time in my life, I did manage a lingerie department. It is an inventory nightmare. There's so many sizes. There's so many variations that the inventory, it's just hard to manage. So it makes sense that in an airport situation, you don't have a lot of room for inventory. You don't have a lot of back storage room. So, yeah, that makes sense to not have bras there. And it just takes up too much space. They make a lot of money off of the body care products. In fact, their Bath and Body Works side of the business has been doing quite well. That's a totally separate company. But they do sell a lot of those products within the store. So the body care side has been doing well. Now, the cosmetics, they're kind of rebooting their whole cosmetic side, and they hired a gentleman from Coach Accessories, which I thought was a very strange hire, to revamp the cosmetics line of Victoria's Secret. So that's kind of a work in progress. I'm not sure how that's going to turn around, but that's what they're going after.
We're talking with Deborah Borchardt. She's a journalist and Forbes contributor. And if you have a question about Victoria's Secret or the cannabis industry, give us a call at 844-WHARTON. That's 844-942-7866. Another of the stories in my book, Deborah, and I'm curious about whether you think that this is parallel to what's happening with Victoria's Secret, is Disney. Because I think Disney, in terms of surrounding its core product with complementary innovations that helped boost revenue and increase the value of its core product, was a pioneer in this. That, you know, they started with animated feature films. That was a big innovation. But, you know, they surrounded it with events at the theaters, the Mickey Mouse Club. They went into theme parks very early and changed the theme park industry. They opened up merchandise stores, the Disney stores. You know, there's just lots of things that they did, Disney branded merchandise, of course. But they really lost their way in the Eisner years. And this has been well documented by other people. But, you know, all those other things became their own business units. They kind of drifted apart. They were more reliable revenue generators than the core business. And so they kind of distracted management away from that core business of telling stories through movies and other kind of creative output like TV shows. And because of that, you know, when that started going downhill, everything around it started going downhill. Do you think that there's an element of this that putting so much focus on, you know, sleepwear, on this side brand of pink, perfume and cosmetics, maybe caused the management to lose focus on the core of lingerie?
Well, that's definitely what Les Wexner, the head of the company, felt. And that's why he decided to cut the swimwear and the apparel side of the businesses, because he felt like, as you mentioned, they were getting too distracted with all these things and needed to focus on their core business, which was bras. There's also several companies online that have come after their market. Now, let's put this in perspective. Victoria's Secret is still the top lingerie seller. They sell more than anyone. They are the market giant. They are the leader. So even though sales have come down, they're still way beyond any of their competition. Having said that, the competition has seen an opening and a crack, and they're starting to come after them, which they never would have attempted in the past. So Wexner realized that and realized, oh my gosh, we've got Third Love. We've got Adore Me. They're coming after our market. We need to protect our market. So let's get rid of the stuff that's distracting us, and let's just focus on our key business. So you have to give him props for recognizing that and making some really difficult decisions and changing that. And that's kind of maybe at the core of your book, is that when you have these long-established companies, the key to success is being able to reinvent yourself and continue to stay innovative. It's great to have that first good idea, but now you got to have the number two good idea, the number three good idea. You have to keep coming up with those good ideas. Look at the Gap. The Gap just can't seem to figure it out year after year after year. And every now and then they have a good idea. And remember, they were the leader for casual workwear. And
yeah,
then that shift changed, and they could not adapt to it, and they've struggled ever since.
Yeah.
So it's key for these big companies to re-innovate.
Yeah, and if you can't keep that core relevant, then there's no reason to do business. I mean, I can't think of, you know, again, I have a wife and a 17-year-old daughter, and so that's my experience. I'm not an expert in this field, of course, but I can't see them wanting to go to Victoria's Secret just for cosmetics or just for perfume. That you go there, if you went there, it would be for their core product, and then you start to see other things that you might also want. And so if that core product is less valuable, then the whole enterprise starts to go down.
But right, and there's another point too with Victoria's Secret, is they don't carry a big size selection, and that's become a real issue. Again, when I talked about cultural shifts and changes, as you know, we have a big shift in the country about loving your size and appreciating your size, and they only go up to a certain size in their bras. So if you're a much bigger girl, you can't shop at Victoria's Secret in the store. They just don't have your size. And so that's coming to haunt them too, whereas some of these online brands, very easy to buy a big size.
We're talking with Deborah Borchardt. She's a journalist and Forbes contributor. And if you have questions about the lingerie industry or the cannabis industry, give us a call at 844-WHARTON. That's 844-942-7866. And so, Deborah, one of the things, you know, I invited you on the show because you've done a lot of work in the lingerie business. But I was also interested, you've started studying the cannabis industry. Why? What did you think was interesting about that from the perspective of a journalist?
You know, I've always been a bit of a trend reporter, picking up on trends and then digging into them. And clearly the cannabis consumer trend is one that is at its probably second inning. It's very early, it's very new, it's emerging. What really got me interested in the beginning was looking at the penny stocks of these companies, and I saw that quite a few of them were fairly shady and dodgy. And as a journalist and a financial reporter, that was something that was near and dear to my heart, was to let consumers know, hey, this is really a shady company. Don't put your money in with this company because they're not who they say they are. And that was just super important to me. As I got into it, I just found it fascinating. I loved the idea that there were children that were sick that were getting help, and I thought that was really important. I also thought it was fascinating to see the numbers that were happening here. Now, let's just put a little bit of this into perspective. So the Canadian market, which is much more mature than our market as far as legalized medical marijuana, and next year we'll have legalized adult use, their recreational market by Deloitte was estimated to be between $4.8 and $6.7 billion. That's per year. That's more than their spirits market.
When wow.
Spirits,
okay.
That's whiskey, rum, vodka.
Okay. Not including beer.
Not including beer. So that just starts to put you into perspective of the market. Now, when you look at the American market, last year we had several states with medical marijuana and adult use marijuana. 2016, the total U.S. legal cannabis market was $6.6 billion.
Wow, so we've passed Canada already.
We will pass Canada pretty quickly. Now, let's just kind of start to, people are like, oh, okay, $6.6 billion, what does that mean? Well, okay, Americans spent about $700 million on Oreos. So more money was spent on pot than on Oreos. More money was spent on pot than on Skittles candy or Reese's candy or Doritos tortilla chips. I mean, that's how much this market is selling, and it's only legal in a handful of states.
Yeah,
and so when you start to look ahead, that's where we're getting these numbers that they expect in 2025. They're estimating that it's going to be a $24 billion market.
So what's new and innovative in the cannabis market? I mean, are they actually going the next obvious step in packaging it with Doritos and Skittles?
Here's what's really started to come out of this innovation, and this is where things start to get kind of interesting. So a lot of the product, you know, originally was grown outdoors. It's a weed. It grows like a weed. So it was grown outdoors. Well, when it starts to become medical, you have to start to protect yourself against bugs and pesticides and all kinds of crazy stuff that happens outside. So they brought a lot of these grow facilities indoors. As a result of bringing them indoors, it's caused the growers to have to make some technological advances. That's where some of the really cool innovation has come in. The way that software is determining the plants getting watered, the plants getting fed, the plants getting sunshine, how many harvests can you have? So, okay, well, that's cannabis. Who cares? Well, okay, let's push that over to the agricultural side. Well, now you can do that with leafy greens, lettuce, other vegetables. Hmm. So you start to see where indoor farming becomes a really critical item, and all this advanced technology is changing not just cannabis indoor farming, but the way you could grow other food indoors. And then you can start to apply that to areas that don't have, you know, the great outdoors that we do in our country in the Midwest or in California or in Texas or in Florida, where all this food is grown outside. You might have a country, say Africa, that could use all this advanced indoor farming to grow food for their people.
And has anybody created a kind of a seed to brownie kind of personal weed factory?
Yeah, there has been innovation in the automation of preparing this product. So again, you know, these numbers start to get quite large. I was talking to a grower in Washington, and he is packaging hundreds of thousands of products a month. He expects he's going to go up into the million units per month of packaging. He can't just do that with human labor. And so he's now automating how the process, how the cannabis is processed once it's taken off the plant, and then also how it's packaged and sealed and barcoded. Now, this kind of thing is kind of normal in your food industry area, but it's pretty innovative in this area because of all the restrictions around the product. So there's a lot of innovation happening there in order to track this product from a seed of a plant all the way to the end product that could be a brownie.
And what's happening with the product itself, the delivery of the THC to people? How is that product being branded, marketed, sold, packaged, et cetera?
Yeah,
and how is that changing?
Kind of, we're seeing a change in the trend here on the, among the consumer. So you have half of the consumer is the bro consumer, as we like to call them. And they're the guys that are like the young guys. They're like, I just want as much as THC as possible for as cheap as possible. Those are the kind of people that, you know, drink a lot of alcohol or whatever. And then you have this other side of the fence that is really looking for a lower THC, a minimal amount, a microdose, as we call it. But then now we're seeing this new trend where people are like, well, I don't really care about all these numbers and this THC and this CBD and all these numbers, all these strains. I just want to be able to smoke this cannabis and relax. Or I just want to be able to smoke this cannabis and still go about my day. I don't want to be, you know, stoned and sitting on the couch and eating a bag of Doritos. I want a little buzz, but I just want to keep going. And so we're starting to see more of these companies selling the cannabis with the mood effect, like hustle or chill or relax. And I know it's or zero. There's one that's come out that you won't get the munchies on.
Oh, okay.
Very appealing to women. It's like I want a little take the edge off, but I don't want to sit down with a bag of Doritos and get fat. So you're seeing a trend towards mood and effect as opposed to the numbers of THCs.
And I noticed you wrote an article about a kind of Birchbox or a set of Birchbox-like services that package weed in some cases or other. It's, in other cases, it's just the complements, other things that might go along with it. What are some of the examples there?
Yeah, there are a few boxes. There's one called O-Box, AU, that is very high-end luxury cannabis products. Of course, the accessories is a big deal in this business. You have multiple types of accessories, from pipes, grinders, which takes the cannabis and grinds it up into little bits so that you can put it in a pipe and put that in your pipe and smoke it, you know, a little easier. All kinds of infused products, from edibles to bath care, body care. So some of these boxes package up these types of items. There are literally thousands of cannabis-related items in the market now. And some of the data companies were telling me that they can't even hardly keep up because hundreds are showing up every single month, hundreds of new products. And again, we're only talking about a handful of states. Can you imagine if this goes nationwide? The numbers of products, it's just enormous. So there you go with all the small businesses, all the innovation of people creating new products, new businesses, new companies. It's just really astounding. I mean, the cannabis industry is adding jobs and thousands of jobs, and you compare that to our manufacturing base, which is losing jobs, you start to see why these states are really protective of this industry and going to Washington and saying, hey, you know what? We really want you to kind of back off because we've got a lot of new business here, a lot of new tax revenue, and we really don't want that to stop.
So what if we wanted to understand where the future of the cannabis industry is going, what should we be watching?
So that brings us to the ultimate point of this industry is it's still federally illegal. Now, that hasn't stopped clearly a lot of states who have legalized it, but at the end of the day, it is still a federally illegal product. The big banks won't touch it. MasterCard and Visa won't touch it. The two major stock exchanges, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, neither of them will touch a company that touches the plant. Very much taboo still. The only way that that is going to change is by an act of Congress. And some people think, well, the FDA can make that change where they can say it's not a controlled substance. The FDA has shown no interest in doing that. The DEA, some say, well, the DEA could say, that's the Drug Enforcement Administration, that they could say, it's okay now. They are not going to do that. And even if these two agencies did, it still, at the end of the day, doesn't change the fact that Congress sees it as illegal. And until Congress changes it, none of this is going to affect these key players. The current administration is certainly not in favor of that. Hmm. You've got Attorney General Jeff Sessions, you've got Tom Price, you've got a drug czar, you've got Chris Christie in his opioid addiction role. You've got several of these people that President Trump has put into power that are very much against legalized marijuana, no matter how the numbers.
Fascinating industry. Yeah. So we've been talking with Deborah Borchardt. She's a journalist and Forbes contributor. Deborah, thanks very much for coming on Innovation Navigation.
Thanks for having me.
So one really interesting story in the book was about Guinness. I think that the Guinness Irish pub concept is a fascinating story of innovation because they Guinness decided to do was to promote the beer, not by changing the beer so much as building a shrine to the beer. And two of the people that were involved in this Irish pub concept, building these shrines to Guinness all over the world, are Donal Balance and Darren Fagan. Donal is currently head of his own Irish pub consulting practice, Balance Hospitality, and he's a former senior brand manager for Guinness and its parent brand, Diageo. So, Donal, welcome to Innovation Navigation.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks and congratulations on bringing out the book.
Oh, thank you. And also on the line is a partner of the Irish Pub Concept and business developer for the Irish Pub Company, Darren Fagan. Darren, great to have you back on the show.
Good morning, Dave. Thank you.
So you were last on the show, both of you, 18 months ago. So let's quickly go back over what the Irish Pub Concept is for those listeners who didn't tune in back then. Darren, how would you describe the Irish Pub Concept?
I think it's a representation of Irish culture and socializing. And, you know, as something that we take for granted in Ireland, we were able to put together and ship that to many places around the world, and my focus here is in North America. But the concept itself really just reflects on how Irish people socialize and the environments that they socialize, and it's really trying to put that into a package and bring it around the world, and that's the complication behind it, but that's more or less it in a nutshell.
And so, Darren, what do you do? What if I wanted to start up an Irish pub, how would you help me?
Well, I think first of all, that most people when they speak to us, there's a huge romantic connection to Ireland and what Ireland is, and that's great, right? You have to be able to identify with that in order to be able to understand how Irish people think and socialise. But then there's the serious part of it, which is the business part of it, and even just mapping out a bar itself, you know, there's a lot of logistics have to be worked out, and there's a lot of common sense decisions that have to be made too. So the first thing would be, once they have a location, of course, and making sure that's secured, and Donal can certainly give you much more information on that and the logic that goes behind site selection. But for us, it's to really just make sure that the space is planned correctly and can be as efficient as it needs to be in order for them to function as a solid business.
And I remember I did my research. Matt Johnson, my producer, and I, we went out to Tiernanogue, which is here in Philadelphia and is one of your products. And I mean, it's striking how you made pains to take a space and made sure it wasn't a plain rectangle, that it had that hidden nooks and crannies and a back bar. And it was this kind of twisty, windy space that was really interesting. And I think added a lot to it.
Yeah, a lot of the character was actually Fideau that you went to. I think Tiernanogue was somebody else's product. But it was Fideau, I believe, in Philadelphia that you're referring to. And the logic behind how we space plan and break things up is behind the idea that when pubs were built many, many years ago, it was people's homes, and they would open up one room as the bar, and as if it got busier, they extended into the rooms of their homes. So that would be a lot of the logic behind having those, you know, separate areas. But for us as designers, it just creates lots of intimate areas and a lot of kind of privacy, and giving people like smaller groups private areas to work in or to socialize in, and it just creates a good social comfortable environment, and it's just something we've been able to have focused on transferring through the concepts we bring to North America and everywhere else around the world. But that would have been in a lot of small country pubs, would have been just rooms of homes, and that would just happen by default.
So, Donal, can you give us a feel for the impact that the pub concept has had on anything, on sales of Guinness, on market shares, are there any numbers you can share with us?
Yeah, I mean, on a global basis, the results certainly through the 90s and the 2000s, the early 2000s were phenomenal. But I can speak to North America this morning. So that there, we estimate there are approximately, give or take 10%, about 3,500 Irish pubs throughout the United States and Canada. And of those, approximately 1,500 to 1,800 would have come about as a direct result of the Irish pub concept. They would have been either part of the development or would have been inspired by. And currently, Diageo tell me that those Irish pubs represent somewhere between 25% and 28% of their total draft Guinness volume in the United States. So it's a very considerable number.
And what is it about, Donald, what is it about an authentic Irish pub that does more to sell Guinness and Harp than just taking a typical rectangular bar and slapping Liam O'Shaughnessy's Irish pub, on it and a couple Shamrocks and Guinness beer signs on the wall?
Yeah, I think you said it earlier. We didn't call it at the time, but the way you describe it as the Irish pub being a shrine to Guinness, that's why it worked so well, because front and center in every single Irish pub in both physically and in terms of the culture of the pub and the quality with which they execute, Guinness sits at the core of all of that. And Guinness is not like most other beers. It's a nitrogenated beer, which means it uses a combination of carbon dioxide and nitrogen. Sorry for the technical bit here, but it's important. It gives it that nice creamy head. So in order to be able to pour a good pint of Guinness, you actually need to be trained in how to do it. So that very fact makes bartenders more concerned, servers more concerned, managers more concerned, owners more concerned that Guinness is poured correctly in an Irish pub. So in a 360 sense, this product is cared for very passionately, very affectionately, and very carefully in an Irish pub.
So, Donald, I got a question for you, and I'm nervous asking this because there's nothing that an academic fears more than somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. But in the book, I asked my readers to do a thought experiment around the pub concept because I thought it was an extreme example of how a company could screw up this approach to innovation. And so I had this, my understanding of the history of the pub concept was that some people from Guinness went out to places in Europe to explore why certain pockets of, geographic pockets were selling a lot of Guinness and others were selling none. And they found that those were located around Irish pubs and that people would go to these Irish pubs, they'd try Guinness, and then they'd keep drinking it outside of the pub. So say it was the 1990s and you go to Germany and you find pockets of Guinness sales and they are occurring around Irish pubs. And maybe you find that there could be some way to create a new variety of Guinness or Harp that would appeal more to German tastes. But the best way to sell Guinness is to build pubs. And in fact, you meet some people that might want to invest in pubs. So you go back and you pitch this idea to Guinness management. They agree this is a great idea. They give you the go-ahead. They put you in charge. They give you a team. And, let's say you're a experienced product manager. You know a great deal about beer development. You're a charismatic person. You've got a great reputation. But the fact is you know nothing about real estate management, restaurant management, architecture, retailing, anything like that. And you'd be given a team, and maybe you'd ask for and get extra legal and business development and finance resources for the pub concept, but they don't know anything about, the partnerships necessary or the contracts or anything else that would be required to help set up and make successful a set of pub owners. And furthermore, probably you'd be forced into a process, a business case, and a set of metrics that are all organized around a relatively short-term process of developing a new variety of beer and not about, creating an entirely different retailing experience in a country that's not used to it. And so your business case would probably be forced into some kind of failure. I mean, the way it'd be constructed would be, so that it would reward a good short-term marketing or beer development process, but something longer-term, like encouraging owners of pubs, would get shot down because the return on investment would be too long. And so probably if you were that hypothetical product manager, you would be you would maybe do successfully in the beer development, but you'd fail miserably because of well-intentioned systems of innovation within Guinness. So I wrote up this thought experiment and didn't consult you guys, but let me start with you, Donald, since you used to work at Guinness. Could it have unfolded that way?
No.
Well, shit, I got to remove the book. Okay, so go ahead.
That's a straight answer. You know, if this was today, I have no doubt that we would have been... Well, let me describe it a different way. As a group, we were somewhat isolated from the rest of the company because nobody knew what we were doing. And they were highly suspicious about what we were doing as well, because, you know, despite the fact that you would think, you know, manufacturing beer is aligned perfectly with getting it into bars and restaurants, we weren't doing it the traditional way, which is putting salespeople on the ground and going into bars and restaurants and selling this product. What we were doing is we were actually creating the bars and the pubs that were going to sell this product. And sell a hell of a lot more than would normally sell in bars and restaurants. So, you know, had we taken a traditional route, we would have been suffocated by bureaucracy and within the company. And despite the fact that Guinness is one of the most innovative companies now and in the past, you know, over the past couple of hundred years, you know, nevertheless, we would have been completely swallowed up by the bureaucracy and the very, you know, the daily grind of trying to get something done through the various structures that were there at the time. It just would not have worked. So, you know, this was a foreign concept for Guinness at the time, and I have no doubt that had we not been physically and culturally isolated within the company, it would never have worked, either on a short term or a long term basis.
Okay, so they were smart enough, Donald, to put you in a separate area. Were you in like a separate building?
We were. We were actually in a separate part of St. James's Gate in Dublin, and I'm not sure that it was a smart decision. I think they just thought we were crazy.
And what led them to spin you off as a separate entity?
Guinness was always interested in innovation, and the then president of the company, managing director as it was of Guinness, was a very visionary individual. And I think it caught his imagination at the time. And so resources were placed, in front of us, and we were allowed the freedom to do whatever we needed to do. And that was a huge part of the success of this. I mean, we were going way beyond, what we would have typically been allowed to do as managers within Guinness, getting into the, you know, real estate game, getting into human resource recruitment, and restaurant management, as you said. So the fact that we were just allowed to do that and we were allowed to develop this ourselves was a huge part of the success of the initiative.
We're talking with Donald Balance, who is currently head of his own Irish pub consulting practice, and Darren Fagan, who is a partner in the Irish pub concept and business developer for the Irish pub company. Darren, you've been listening to this. What's your perspective on what would have happened if Guinness had tried to do this themselves as part of their existing innovation process and structure?
Well, I'm certainly not going to contradict Donald. I mean, he nailed it, right? So I think Guinness were very sharp in how they were able to separate, you know, beer salespeople over the concept people. And that was the move that made it happen. Because if it had been beer people, the focus would have been on beer and not the concept and the interiors, which is another part of it, but they're not the same. And there's, even the logics don't apply, because when you talk about sales, it's about micro numbers and managing it at a very micro level. With interior design, particularly Irish pub design, there's not everything is logical, right? So even the way we break up rooms and so on, just in some cases don't make sense. And part of our job as a company is to build up the confidence in the client to be able to make, or to convince them that a lot of the decisions we're making and how we're breaking things down and separating them into different rooms actually does work for the concept. And if you're, from the beer side, it's just too straight lined, and sometimes curves work, right? So if that explains or adds to the explanation, but definitely I would agree it wouldn't have happened if it just had been the traditional beer, the beer element of it, or the people within that part of the business were to try and coordinate the interior part of the concept. It just, it's just two different thought processes. And yeah.
So it sounds, Darren, like from what Donald was saying, that Guinness was smart in terms of putting them in their own building and separating them from the rest of the business. But they also spun it off as a separate business that you're a part of now. Do you think that if you were still some division of Guinness, that over time they might have hurt your ability to execute? This is a question for Darren.
It's hard to know because it worked so well when it did happen, when we had the support from the Guinness team, because their focus was mostly on how we were able to, you know, produce this product for the client. Whether it would have hurt it or not, I don't know, because there's just been so many changes along the way, factors that are, you know, outside forces that have influenced or taken away from the concept along the way. Not necessarily all Guinness-related. So it's hard to know the answer to that question.
You're listening to Innovation Navigation on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. And we're talking with Donal Balance and Darren Fagan about the Guinness pub concept. Donal, in our last interview a year and a half ago, we talked a little bit about the 2.0 concept. In other words, you know, what's next? This is a wonderful story of what Guinness did, you know, starting in the 90s to encourage sales of Guinness beer. But a lot is changing, both about beer. Here in the U.S., craft breweries are way up and almost a victim of their own success. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about how sales are declining because there's so many craft breweries, and some are getting bought by the big brewers. But also things are changing in fast casual dining, which is part of the Irish pub concept. What is next for the Irish pub concept? And again, I'll start with you, Darren.
It's a great question because there was a number of things happened in the last 5 years, maybe even before that, last 8 years. The economy slowed down, people weren't investing, they weren't able to get money. So it looked like the pub industry, or just, you know, restaurant industry as a whole, amongst other industries, were just going to collapse. But the quality pubs, the great pubs, held their ground. They understood what they were, and they were able to just make some adjustments in order for them to survive. People weren't spending as much money. But in that same period, a new generation of customer evolved, as we refer to as millennials, whether in a good way or a bad way. But they're redirecting how the social scene. And there was a lot of templates that we would have in place for how the Irish pub concept went together from, you know, the early 90s through even up to about, you know, 8 years ago. Most of them are just gone out the window now, because you really have to think about how these customers are actually socializing. And it's forcing us to be followers as much as we were leaders. The craft industry, whether it's beer, whether it's tequila, you know, there's so many craft industries out there, and they're all becoming part of the concept. So it's not just about dark beer anymore, because if you were to think that way, well, then you can't be successful only because the demands are elsewhere. Now, that's not to say you don't put it in the forefront and say this is our primary product, but you have to focus on other things too outside of just Irish beer. And that's one of the things that we're having to relate to, is everything else that's going on around us and, you know, coming outside that cocoon that was everything Irish.
Donal, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Irish pub, the Guinness Irish pub concept had a great shelf life from 1992 or thereabouts right through until, you know, probably 7 or 8 years ago. And then, you know, the casual dining landscape has changed dramatically in North America over the past 7 or 8 years. You know, as you quite rightly say, with the advent of concepts in fast casual dining and so on. And we got to remember that at one point, 15 years ago, the typical Irish pub out there probably had the best beer system in place, a draft beer install system, because they took huge care with it, where, you know, most bars were limited to kegerators under the counter and so on. And things have changed. Now the competition for Irish pubs are doing, you know, a lot of craft beers. They have to have a beer draft system, which is very good. And, you know, Guinness, or sorry, the Irish pubs, which once would have had Guinness as arguably, you know, the biggest craft and the best craft beer of all sitting on their counter, now it's sitting on the counter with some competing stouts and other craft beers. So there's a lot of challenge to the Irish pub of, you know, Irish pub 2.0, and it has to respond to, there have been, you know, massive changes in demographics in the United States. We're trying to figure out how to make Irish pubs relevant to celebrating Cinco de Mayo. We're trying to figure out, you know, what, you know, we know that millennials look at fish and chips and they say, there's maybe a few too many calories in that. And so the model for walking into an Irish pub is not to order fish and chips and a pint of Guinness. It's to look at small plates. It's to look at perhaps an artisanal cocktail or a tisane that dates from, you know, the early 1900s or something like that. So we're looking at many, many options to continue to make the Irish pub relevant to its consumers.
Fascinating. So we've been talking with Donal Balance. He's currently head of his own Irish pub consulting practice, Balance Hospitality, and he's a former senior brand manager for Guinness. And with Darren Fagan, he's a partner in the Irish pub concept and business developer for the Irish pub company. So Darren and Dolan, thanks very much for coming on Innovation Navigation.
Thank you, Dave.
You're very welcome, David. Thank you.
So that's our show about sex and drugs and alcohol and my new book, The Power of Little Ideas. You're listening to Innovation Navigation on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'd like to thank our sound engineer, Danielle Bruno, our associate producer, Dion Simpkins, our head researcher, Julia Cox, our podcast editor, Mike Hanley, our producer, Matt Johnson, and our program director, Patty Hall. You're listening to Innovation Navigation on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm Dave Robertson, and I'll be back again next week.